Well, good evening, everyone. I'm Mark Elliott. I'm the faculty chair, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you to this evening's Mackenzie Stewart lecture. As many of you will know, Lord Mackenzie Stewart was an alumnus of Cambridge University. He became the first British judge of the European Court of Justice in 1973 and went on to serve as the court's president from 1984 to 88. It was to honour his contribution and to celebrate the connections between the university and the institutions of the EU and the Council of Europe that this lecture series was founded in 1997. And ever since then, we have been fortunate to attract a galaxy of outstanding speakers, including members of the Court, the Commission, and the Council Legal Service. Indeed, our own Professor Eleanor Sharpstone, a former Advocate General, and this year's Arthur Goodhart Visiting Professor, delivered this lecture in 2009. And we're delighted that Shifra O'Leary has accepted the invitation to be this year's Mackenzie Stewart Lecturer. She was appointed as the Irish Judge to the European Court of Human Rights in 2015 and elected President of the Court in 2022. She thus became the 16th president of the court and the first woman to lead it. President O'Leary studied law at University College Dublin, earning her doctorate at the EUI in Florence. She was then assistant director of the Centre for European Legal Studies here at Cambridge from 1995-96 and a fellow of Emmanuel College. In that capacity, she worked closely with Professor Sir Alan Dashwood, who is here this evening as well, developing the academic programme and the international profile of CELS. She went on to spend almost 20 years working within the Court of Justice of the EU in a variety of senior roles before her appointment to the Strasbourg Court. During that time and since, President O'Leary has lectured and written extensively on a variety of topics, including the protection of fundamental rights, EU employment law, free movement of persons and services, and EU citizenship. And this evening, she will address us on the topic of why the European Convention on Human Rights still matters. Thank you very much indeed for being here.
Thank you very much, Professor Elliott. Ladies and gentlemen, it's a real honour to deliver the 25th Mackenzie Stewart Lecture and to pay tribute to a Scottish advocate appointed as the United Kingdom's first judge at what is now the Court of Justice of the European Union. While I never met Lord Mackenzie Stewart, his remarkable contribution to the European Court, which he went on to preside, is partially captured in the following words of the late Italian judge, Federico Mancini. Explaining the impact on the Luxembourg Court of the arrival of judges from common law member states, Mancini wrote, and I quote, "Their most conspicuous contribution concerns the style and the format of the hearings. The typical advocate in continental Europe is accustomed to put on his robe, make his submissions, and bid adieu. If a member of the bench dares to question, let alone interrupt him, he's at a loss, coughs, stares at the ceiling, and grumbles a usually irrelevant answer. Some go as far as to resent these judicial interferences. The advent of the two insular judges put an end to such habits. Their colleagues loved their refusal to accept listlessly the kind of assistance which the lawyers were prepared to give. If the two European courts have been heavily and positively influenced by common law judicial practices and thinking, which in my experience for over almost 30 years they have, then this is in no small part down to legal pioneers like Lord Mackenzie Stewart. But the principal reason for the pleasure I have in dedicating a lecture to the Honourable Judge lies in his experience as a young man in Europe during the Second World War and the impact of that experience on his approach to multilateralism and integration through law. Concluding his 16-year tenure in Luxembourg, he recalled the indelible effect of seeing the ashes of the Ruhr in the spring of 1945. These were his words on leaving the Court of Justice. In creating the new climate, that court has played an essential indeed a pivotal role. It has been the greatest privilege to participate in that great adventure and to use the words of the Schuman Declaration of 1953 to see the European construction taking shape. Since the Luxembourg and the Strasbourg courts represent the judicial backbone of European multilateralism, a multilateralism which, let's face it, is sometimes in certain places bitterly contested nowadays, we should regret the passing of that generation of judges which directly lived the events from which the Council of Europe, the European Union, and the two European courts were born. But this evening, we gather to honour their European legal legacy. And finally, as Professor Elliott mentioned, as a former Associate Director of CELS and a Fellow of Emmanuel College, I'm delighted to return to a faculty which welcomed me as a young lawyer in the mid-1990s. If my stay in Cambridge proved to be quite short-lived, it was simply because in European law I had found my calling. And I should say that when I left, this was much to the bemusement of some members of the faculty who couldn't understand why a bright young lawyer would go to the Court of Justice in Luxembourg. And a special thanks this evening to Alan Dashwood, who made Cambridge a warm and welcoming home for me at that occasion. Having served both European courts in different roles, I hope I enjoy quite a solid basis to address this evening's topic, namely why in 2023 the European Convention on Human Rights still really does matter. Reviewing the topics which have been the subject of the 24 preceding lectures, I'm struck by the fact that only one, human rights, has been recurrent. In 2008 and 2018, Jack Straw and Dominic Grieve, respectively, addressed questions relating to the means and manner of the protection of human rights in the United Kingdom. Both spoke in their capacity as members of Parliament, and both tackled head-on the contested nature of such rights in UK political discourse. As a sitting judge, you can imagine I do not enjoy the same freedom as those two speakers. And I'm also sensitive to the fact that this evening I'm delivering a lecture in the United Kingdom at a very particular point in time. The consequences of Brexit are now embedded in the law, and parliamentary attention has turned elsewhere. The original February date for this lecture, postponed due to strike action, was against the backdrop of the then proposed legislation to replace the Human Rights Act. As fate, or luck would have it, I now speak to you a few weeks after the Supreme Court delivered its judgment on government policy to relocate asylum seekers to Rwanda, and with proposals to leave the convention actively discussed in certain circles. Let me stress that serving judges do not comment on matters of government or parliamentary policy, still less judges from an international court like mine. There's no call for me this evening to engage with previous domestic legislative proposals to alter your human rights architecture. Those tabled at that time were the subject of lengthy and careful discussion amongst domestic actors, including several former judges, such as Lords Mance, Carnworth, Dyson, Gross, and multiple members of civil society. And those proposals have since been withdrawn. Equally, the convention compliance of any legislative changes adopted since and now in force is not something which falls for me to discuss this evening in an academic setting. Such questions, if and when they arise, will do so in concrete cases lodged in Strasbourg. And that will only happen after effective domestic remedies have been exhausted. Furthermore, any examination wouldn't be in the abstract. It would only occur in relation to the way in which such legislative changes affect an alleged victim or group of victims, and always against the backdrop of what is now extensive Strasbourg case law. Yet it's inevitable that some of what I say this evening may be assessed in the light of your ongoing domestic debate. And it's a debate, as we see from the speeches of Straw and Grieve, which has been running in different forms for nearly two decades. As such, I consider it useful to preface my core remarks with a brief reference to key factors which influence a Strasbourg's judge's perspective on the UK's relationship with the Convention and the court which I serve. That relationship can often seem fragile, even brittle. This is perhaps influenced by the repeated and varying moves to adapt what I've just referred to, your domestic human rights architecture, and more importantly, on the grounds relied on to change it. Having been a member of the panel of Strasbourg judges which was interviewed by Lord Gross as part of the independent review of the Human Rights Act, I think the best place for me to turn in my preliminary remarks is to concrete evidence which reflects the nature of the relationship seen from Strasbourg. First of all, I'm certainly not the first person in this setting, and I won't be the last, to highlight the central role played by the United Kingdom in the drafting of the convention. UK influence sought both precision in how the rights were to be framed and symmetry between convention rights and those already reflected in the common law. The UK was one of the first states to sign the convention on the day it was adopted, and it was the first state to ratify it. And its influence on the convention and Strasbourg case law has been manifest ever since. Over the last two decades, the Human Rights Act has led to a closer alignment between Strasbourg and the UK domestic courts in the application of the rights and the freedoms the subject of the convention. This has undoubtedly resulted in a reduction in the number of cases against the United Kingdom before the Strasbourg court, but also in the number and the nature of any violations found. If we still celebrate today the convention principles established in some of those seminal judgments, and I'll mention some of them shortly, we can't forget the much higher case and violation count throughout the first decade of the UK's adherence to the convention. And this was quite simply due to the absence at that time of a tailored mechanism for violations of human rights to be remedied within the domestic system. Those first decades also put paid to the idea, which had perhaps been mistakenly nurtured by some of the drafters and signatories, that the convention was for other states and not a matter of domestic concern. Looking at our statistics in Strasbourg for allocated applications by population, the UK now ranks as the lowest amongst the 46 member states, at 0.04 applications per 10,000 inhabitants. The only two states to come close are Ireland and Germany, with 0.06. Beyond the seminal cases in which the UK featured as a respondent state, your influence as a legal order, whether in terms of domestic judgments cited and relied on or interventions by the United Kingdom as a third-party intervener, should also be mentioned. The most commonly cited example of the former is the reliance in the Grand Chamber judgment in SV&A against Denmark, which concerned Article 5 and preventive detention, on the reasoning of the UK Supreme Court in R. Hicks against Commissioner of the Police. And you should see also the recent judgment of the court in Y against France from January this year, where it relied on the Supreme Court in a case called Elan Kane, which some of you must know, the case related to Article 8, and whether it entailed positive obligations to recognise a third neutral gender. As regards the UK's active participation in Strasbourg proceedings as a third-party intervener, I refer you, by way just of one example, to its submissions alongside Ireland in the first request for an advisory opinion under Protocol 16 in a case on surrogacy, despite the fact that neither of those two states have ratified the protocol. And in Bankovic, the core of which has remained at the heart of the court's interpretation of Article 1 jurisdiction, the oral submissions by the UK were made on behalf of all the respondent states. Just a few weeks ago, I presided the Grand Chamber in a case called Duarte Agostino, in which the young applicants are challenging state omissions in relation to the need to combat climate change. And the 33 respondent states coordinated their pleadings on that occasion, and they were led by a UK King's Counsel. The brittleness at times of the domestic debate to which I've just referred thus seems, quite frankly, from an Irish common law perspective, but also from a continental perspective, to entirely overlook the effective influence and engagement of the UK with the Strasbourg court over the years. Based on the incontrovertible evidence at our disposal, our submissions to the Gross Inquiry were thus to the effect that the Human Rights Act, from a Strasbourg perspective, appeared entirely fit for purpose. It has done and continues to do a very good job of embedding the convention into the domestic legal system and strengthening the culture of human rights in the UK. UK domestic courts engage, and I'm seeing Lady Arden here, and she can confirm this, often rigorously and sometimes very critically with convention principles. But they speak the language of the convention, and they seek to apply those principles faithfully at domestic level. Furthermore, as we saw in the recent Rwanda judgment, in relation to a given legal question, the convention may be only one of several international legal systems instruments to which this state has sovereignly subscribed. And in addition, the obligations which it contains may, more often than not, be reflected in statute and in the common law. In short, the judgments issued by the International Court, which I serve, are not the main or only reason for decisions which influence how government policy must be developed. As someone familiar with EU law, it's also striking, I should add, what little public awareness there is of the causal link between EU exit and the absence of return mechanisms in relation to the EU member states from whence many migrants arrive. The level of embeddedness of the convention in UK law is reflected extremely well in how the Strasbourg Court responds in terms of the principle of subsidiarity, but also the margin of appreciation. In a leading judgment on the expulsion of a non-national, long-term resident convicted of serious crime, the case is called Ndidi against the United Kingdom, the court emphasized the following, and I quote, "In Article 8 cases, it has generally understood the margin of appreciation to mean that where the independent and impartial domestic courts have carefully examined the facts, applying the relevant human rights standards consistently with the Convention and its case law, and adequately balanced the applicant's personal interests against the more general public interest in the case, it's not for the court in Strasbourg to substitute its own assessment of the merits for that of the competent national authorities." The Ndidi judgment isn't an isolated one. It illustrates both the established dialogic relationship which has developed between the UK courts and the European Court in Strasbourg over the years, and the location of the primary responsibility for compliance with the convention obligations as lying with national authorities. Your domestic debate and events in Europe more generally, however, do provide a reminder of why it is worth discussing the continued added value of the European Convention. As regards the general context, in a speech delivered last year, the Chief Justice of Ireland commented that the post-war model of judicial protection of human rights is under more challenge today in more significant ways and in more locations than at any time since 1945. Strasbourg judges, I must admit, know from experience that the post-war model has never really gone unchallenged, and that in some quarters it was never really fully accepted. However, it does feel, turn on the news any evening, that we are at a watershed moment. For the purposes of my lecture, and given the time constraints, I'll concentrate on four broad themes as an illustration of why the European Convention really does still matter. The first theme, which focuses on the Convention as an instrument of peace and stability in Europe, is illustrated by the tragic events which have unfolded since the 24th of February 2022 and the new geopolitical situation in which we now find ourselves in Europe and beyond. Following the decision in March last year that Russian membership of the Council of Europe had ceased, the court explained that it remains competent by virtue of the residual jurisdiction conferred by Article 58, paragraphs 2 and 3 of the Convention, to deal with applications directed against the Russian Federation. This jurisdiction is, of course, restricted to acts and omissions capable of constituting a violation of the Convention if they occurred prior to the 16th of September 2022, the latter being the date on which the Russian Federation ceased to be bound by the obligations it had assumed under the Convention and its protocols. The Court has handed down many decisions and judgments in applications directed against Russia since February 2022, and many more will follow. However, for the purposes of this evening's lecture, I think one of the most expressive is the admissibility decision delivered in open court in January this year in the case of Ukraine and the Netherlands against Russia. The case concerns the invasion of eastern Ukraine in 2014 and the downing of Malaysia Airlines flight MH17 with the loss of almost 300 lives. In a series of important preliminary observations, the court recalled, and I quote, "The purpose in concluding the Convention was not to concede to each other reciprocal rights and obligations in pursuance of their individual national interests, but to establish a common public order of the free democracies of Europe with the object of safeguarding their common heritage of political traditions, ideals, freedom, and the rule of law." It went on, "It follows that when a high contracting party or parties refer an alleged breach of the Convention to the court under Article 33, they are not to be regarded as exercising a right of action for the purpose of enforcing their own rights, but rather as bringing before the court an alleged violation of the public order of Europe." As you know, several international courts and bodies are playing a role in addressing the Russian Federation's actions in Ukraine. But for now, the Strasbourg Court is the only international court engaged at the merits stage, and it is the only court charged with examining alleged violations of human rights. At a time when Europe is once again witnessing armed conflict and devastation, it's thus the Convention's vocation as an instrument of peace which resonates first and foremost. And at the heart of the court's role in respect of both conflict prevention and conflict resolution lies the interstate application. Since 1953, 44 interstate applications have been allocated to a judicial formation, compared to the total number of applications allocated for the same period, which is over 1.1 million, one can say that recourse to Article 33 and interstate applications is extremely rare. However, the last decade has seen a marked increase in the number of interstate applications before the court. We now have 13 pending, with approximately 10,000 individual applications which are related. These figures suggest a confidence in the role that can be played by the European Convention in responding to disputes that arise at interstate level within the Council of Europe. Both interstate judgments and those in individual cases contribute to the establishment of historical and factual truth. They respond to our society's need to know what happened, and in addition, they can act as a basis for further judicial proceedings, as well as restitution mechanisms such as the Register of Damage established by the Council of Europe states, including the United Kingdom, at the Fort Summit in May this year. The Convention has sought and it seeks to create a climate in which the escalation of conflict becomes less likely. In the words of one of my predecessors, Lucius Wildhaber, the Convention is in essence the product of idealistic realism. It is anchored in the belief that democratic regimes, respectful of fundamental rights, don't go to war with one another. Where conflict does occur, states and individuals, victims of conflict, can turn to the court for reparation, but also for a public statement of the violation of international law. The Convention is thus a mechanism whose creation the United Kingdom inspired and whose functioning it has largely endorsed for over 70 years. It is a mechanism which ensures that in just over a week, in a case called Ukraine against Russia concerning Crimea, I will lead the Grand Chamber, and a further hearing will be held in Ukraine and the Netherlands against Russia in spring, hopefully, of 2024. It is also a protection mechanism which allows 26 Council of Europe states, including the United Kingdom, to intervene in support of accountability for violations of international law and in a defence of what I just referred to, the common public order of the free democracies of Europe. The second theme, illustrative of the Convention's enduring importance, is access to justice. In its landmark judgment in Golder against the United Kingdom, decided in 1975, and I imagine most of you weren't born, the Strasbourg Court held that Article 6 of the Convention guarantees a right of access to court. Although that provision didn't expressly provide for such a right, the court held that the rights to fair, public, and expeditious proceedings, which it does guarantee, would have absolutely no value if there was no access to courts and therefore no such proceedings to begin with. In Éire in Ireland, the court held 4 years later, 1979, that Article 6, Paragraph 1 may sometimes compel the state to provide for the assistance of a lawyer when such assistance proves indispensable for effective access to court. This may be the case either because there is an obligation to provide for legal representation in law or because of the complexity of a given procedure or of a given case. These two cases have never lost their relevance. They've been relied on in multiple, I would say hundreds or thousands of cases involving different Council of Europe states to find violations of Article 6. And the difficulties which the Strasbourg Court highlighted in the 1970s continue to resonate in this and other jurisdictions to this day. Coventry against the United Kingdom is a very recent and eloquent example of what Article 6 can do. We know that there are cases where individuals have suffered wrongdoing, but they're unable to effectively assert their rights because of the cost of going to court. And in this jurisdiction, Lord Reid, before becoming president of the court, expressed concerns about such developments in the unanimous judgment of the Supreme Court delivered in 2017 in unison. Courts, he said, do not merely provide a public service like any other. Access to the courts is not therefore of value only to the particular individuals involved. That's most obviously true of cases which establish principles of general importance. Every day, in the courts and tribunals of this country, the names of people who brought cases in the past live on as shorthand for the legal rules and principles which their cases established. It's true that Lord Reid emphasised at the time that access to justice has long been deeply embedded in UK constitutional law, and extrajudicially he pointed out that the Convention had only played a supporting role in the Unison case. But in a Convention system based on shared responsibility, it is precisely the Convention's vocation to play a subsidiary role. The important point is the guarantee of effective access to court, not the preferred legal base with reference to which that access is secured. What the 1979 Airy judgment stressed was the positive obligation on high contracting parties to provide effective access to justice to litigants at national level. And effective access to justice for litigants is also what the Convention seeks to provide to those who consider that national remedies or national authorities have failed. Since the amendment introduced by Protocol 11, the right to individual application is confirmed as being at the heart of the Convention system. And hundreds and thousands of litigants or their relatives have turned to the Strasbourg Court when they failed at national level, and their names are now associated with the Convention rights and principles of great importance which they successfully defended. Let me give you a few examples, citing, where possible, UK cases. McCann on the duty of states to effectively investigate. Söring and Ireland against the United Kingdom on the prohibition of torture and inhumane and degrading treatment. VCL and AN on human trafficking. Ilgar Mammadov against Azerbaijan on detention for political motives. Ibrahim and others on the right of access to lawyer. Kavala against Turkey on the right to fair trial. Del Rio Prada against Spain on retroactive application of case law. Christine Goodwin on the rights of transgendered persons, or Dudgeon on the open expression of one's sexuality. Aveda on the right to manifest one's religion and the limits thereto. Navalny against Russia on the right to freedom of expression and association. J.D. and A. on discriminatory treatment of certain vulnerable categories of social housing tenants. My third illustration of why the Convention still matters centres on the rule of law. The Strasbourg Court has consistently held that the rule of law forms part of and inspires the fabric of the whole Convention and is inherent in all of its articles. Over the years, the Court has developed various substantive guarantees which may be inferred from this notion, and I won't delve into them this evening. Some of them are a little bit dry. I'll leave the detail to the written paper. But they all aim at protecting the individual from arbitrariness. Serious attacks on judicial independence in recent years within the EU and Council of Europe states have led to a marked increase in disputes before the Luxembourg and the Strasbourg courts, which raise questions regarding the independence and impartiality of judges. In a system of shared responsibility, such as that established by the Convention, the integrity of the system itself requires the existence of strong and independent national courts, able to adjudicate free of influence, but also to exercise meaningful judicial oversight over national authorities. Sadly, we now have extensive case law in Strasbourg relating to recruitment and appointment of judges, career and promotion, transfer, suspension, disciplinary proceedings, or the removal of judges from their posts while formerly they remain judges. In a case called Aðstrúðsson against Iceland, the Grand Chamber examined the process for the appointment of judges to the newly established Icelandic Court of Appeal. It held, finding a violation in that case, that serious defects in the appointment of judges may give rise to a violation of the right of access to court established by law. That Grand Chamber judgment reminds us that the establishment of independent and impartial tribunals in accordance with the law is something which we must seek to protect in all European states, even those where democracy and the rule of law don't otherwise appear that fragile. The convention arsenal for safeguarding judicial independence is not either limited to Article 6. For example, in Baca against Hungary, the president of the Hungarian Supreme Court, who had previously been a judge in Strasbourg, complained under Article 10 that his mandate had been terminated as a result of his critical views, which he had expressed in his capacity as president of the Supreme Court and the National Council of Justice. As judges, we have to accept a duty of reserve when it comes to public statements and interview. However, as the court acknowledged in Baca, judges may at times have a duty, and not simply a right, to express their opinion on legislative reforms which are likely to have an impact on the judiciary and its independence. The tenor of the Baca judgment, where the court found a violation of Article 10, is sadly now repeated regularly in judgments relating to judges and prosecutors from Poland, Bulgaria, Romania, Ukraine, and beyond, who have brought cases to Strasbourg following their dismissal or the imposition of disciplinary sanctions. And of course, we in this room might comfort ourselves that in your state or in mine, such cases are unlikely to emanate from either jurisdiction, given how deeply entrenched judicial independence and the rule of law are in our written and unwritten constitutional settlements. However, given the many different forms which rule of law backsliding can take, one should wonder whether our confidence in the resilience of our own systems is well placed. Just 1 week ago, my native city, Dublin, was in flames. Just 3 years ago, and I'm just going to mention one example in the recent past, a minister informed the Commons that a piece of post-Brexit legislation, which affected the withdrawal agreement, would break international law, but, he added, only in a specific and limited way. Even if our confidence in our own systems is well placed, let's opt instead for a purely mercantile approach. Whether inside or outside the EU, the states that I've just referred to are our trading partners. Those are the legal systems on which contracts, disputes, trade, and business all rely. And it's difficult, whichever is the perspective you choose, not to see the advantage of belonging to a system which requires compliance with minimum convention standards designed to safeguard the rule of law and which provides as a last resort for an external subsidiary control. Returning to the values-based perspective with which I started and which is why I do my job, the 26 intervening states in the pending interstate case, Ukraine and the Netherlands against Russia, they intervene because they are strongly committed to the protection and promotion of the international rule of law. And as that case demonstrates under the convention, the importance of the rule of law can't simply be reduced to questions of judicial independence, which, let's face it, for the majority of the public are quite dry, quite far away from their daily experience. There are other strands to the rule of law under the convention which are not immediately associated with it, but which are nevertheless of fundamental importance to the type of societies in which we aspire to live. Secret rendition cases, for example, provide a window into how the Strasbourg Court uses the rule of law as an interpretative tool for the development of substantive guarantees under rights such as Articles 2, 3, and 5. The Al-Masri case is the one I use to show what happens when an individual is subject to extraordinary rendition and detention outside the normal legal system. Some of you may know the case. The applicant was a German national. He was detained at the North Macedonian border, held incognito for 23 days in a hotel, interrogated repeatedly, subjected to various forms of torture, forcibly tranquilized, and flown on a CIA aircraft to Kabul, where he was held captive for months. The court held that the treatment to which he had been subjected violated Article 3 of the Convention, stating that it is wholly unacceptable that in a state subject to the rule of law, a person could be deprived of his liberty in an extraordinary place of rendition outside any judicial framework. Again, there may be an inadvertent tendency on our part to comfort ourselves that while this case concerned a German national, the events took place far away, outside this jurisdiction, on the territory of a non-EU, albeit European, state. However, similar stories of abuse can be found throughout the Strasbourg Court's case law, Al-Nashiri against Romania, Abu Zadai against Lithuania, Nasser and Ghali against Italy. And furthermore, we don't have to look very far back into the history of our own two islands, which are bound together by geography, history, language, economics, politics, family ties, but also conflict, to remember that brutality doesn't occur in far-off places to far-off people whose names we don't properly pronounce. In 1949, as the post-war framework for the protection of democracy, human rights, and the rule of law, from which we now all benefit, without even realizing, was being constructed, Hirsch Lauterpacht, a proud scholar of this university, wrote as follows. Even in countries in which the rule of law is an integral part of the national heritage, and in which the courts have been the faithful guardians of the rights of the individual, there is room for a procedure which will put the imprimatur of international law upon the principle that the state is not the final judge of human rights. Then and now, when defending the rule of law, in all its different dimensions, the European Convention clearly matters. My fourth and last theme, illustrating the Convention's continued importance, focuses on its ability to bring oxygen into ongoing debates and to cast light on national blind spots. The question I asked last year, along with a compatriot who's sitting at the back, Colm O'Kinnida, is, of course, you can ask, so what, in essence, has the European Convention of Human Rights ever done for you? I raised this question when the Strasbourg Court visited the courts in Dublin, and I emphasised on that and other occasions, and I'll do so tonight, the character of a state is defined in a fundamental way by its fundamental law, whether the constitution is written or unwritten. Therein lies its constitutional identity, informing its whole body of laws, ordering its democratic life, and to some extent grounding the policy and actions of government. And it's not the vocation of a human rights treaty or international human rights judges to override, substitute, or compete with that. However, I made the case in my own state for why the convention still matters. The relatively small number of Irish Strasbourg cases is in inverse proportion to their long-lasting, dramatic social effects and the change that they brought to my society. Sometimes the Strasbourg court has had to push Ireland for required change, but it has acted as an essential ally for national judges who are seeking the same. The provision of suitable detention facilities for young, troubled offenders is a case in point. In some other cases, it has quite literally had to shove the state. The case of Louise O'Keefe and historical child abuse in primary schools is such an example. But in many other situations, the case law of the court has successfully nudged the state, little by little, into recognizing and rectifying its blind spots. This method works when the respondent state accepts that under the convention, it's the state and not the court in Strasbourg which bears primary responsibility for assuring respect for convention rights. So in this jurisdiction, are you blessed with the Magna Carta, the common law, an unwritten constitution, and a highly respected judicial system? Are you so different to the rest? I would put it to you this evening that decades of Strasbourg case law would suggest otherwise. To give one example, in the late 1990s at issue in a case called Smith and Grady and Lustig, Preen and Beckett was the investigation and discharge from the army of the applicants solely on the grounds of their sexual orientation. The Court of Appeal had held in the relevant cases that since the policy was supported by Parliament and those advising the ministry, it was lawful. The applicants were refused leave to appeal to the House of Lords. The Strasbourg Court held that there was a violation of Articles 8 and 13 of the Convention, but no violation of Articles 3 and 14. But in finding that the Article 3 threshold wasn't reached in these particular cases, the court stated as followed, the treatment which is grounded upon a predisposed bias on the part of a heterosexual majority against a homosexual minority of the nature described could, in principle, fall within the scope of Article 3. In response, in January, the government lifted the ban, the government lifted the ban and introduced a policy of zero tolerance as regards harassment, discrimination, and bullying. These cases led to important and now widely accepted reforms propelled by the Strasbourg Court. But let me add, the Strasbourg Court, to which the then Master of the Rolls, in his judgment, had clearly directed the applicants. We have recently seen how they continue to provide oxygen in an ongoing national conversation. In May of this year, the LGBT Veterans Independent Review by Lord Etherton was published. It documents the treatments which the veterans experienced under the ban, and it makes several recommendations. One is the establishment of a system for awarding compensation to affected individuals, referring in detail to the Strasbourg Court judgments. The decision whether or not to implement such a compensation scheme is, of course, a matter for domestic lawmakers. But my point is simply to highlight one series of cases and their reflection of a simple convention truth. Tolerance and broad-mindedness, along with pluralism, are the hallmarks of a modern democratic society. In many cases where violations have been found, the court has simply sought to remedy blind spots within national systems, blind spots which may have been very difficult for national judges to identify or to remedy themselves, given that the roots are often to be found in national, cultural, social, or religious heritage, or because of the limited nature of the judicial review which national judges considered themselves entitled to exercise. Leaving aside the work of the court, the convention system and all it entails was central to the Good Friday Agreement, and it underpins the modern devolution settlement in Northern Ireland. Peace in our time, something which I never thought I would see as a child living on the island of Ireland, is not something which we can dismiss lightly. And leaving the UK and Ireland aside, think of the institutional intolerance of domestic violence, which we see on display in cases like Opus against Turkey, Talpas against Italy, or Tagayeva against Russia, or the secondary victimization of complainants in sexual violence cases, such as JL against Italy. To whom are such applicants to turn if they cannot turn to Strasbourg? In her recent debate with Lord Sumption in The Spectator, Jessica Seymour invited the public to think of other UK examples, and I can do no better than to refer you to her list. The convention is, of course, an international treaty, and it is states' sovereign prerogative to choose whether to remain high contracting parties to it. However, were any decision to be taken on continued membership, one would hope that all the evidence, forensically compiled and objectively presented, would be placed before the decision makers. It has also been claimed recently that the convention has devalued the whole concept of human rights and been transformed, I quote, from a noble body of truly fundamental principles almost universally shared into something at once intrusive and banal. However, when the evidence is compiled and assessed in the manner I suggest, it's difficult to find that the charges which are levelled at Strasbourg are made out. Those who complain about Strasbourg interference with democratic processes seem to forget judgments like animal defenders against the United Kingdom and the many judicial iterations of the same which have followed. In that case, the court emphasised the quality of the parliamentary and judicial review of the necessity of the measure is of particular importance. Furthermore, it is too often forgotten that the living instrument document affects not just the scope of rights or the applicability of convention provisions, in relation to which, since it is a living instrument, at times the court has been expansive. But it also influences the court's approach to the balance which is inherent in the entire convention, where the effect may be one of recalibration in the light of, for example, a changing context or the development of scientific knowledge. It is clearly the case that the living instrument document is an important methodological tool allowing convention rights to remain relevant to the contemporary European landscape. However, it's applied in a manner consistent with the limitations imposed by the fundamental principles of the margin of appreciation and subsidiarity. Turning to my conclusion, when speaking in states where the convention system is contested, it's tempting to cite, as I've done this evening, examples of cases in relation to that state where no violations have been found, to point to the principle of subsidiarity in the margin of appreciation, and to impress upon the listener the modest nature of the Strasbourg Court's judicial enterprise in regard to that state. The careful recalibration by the Court in recent years in what has been described as the age of subsidiarity can also be emphasised on such occasions. And this, too, I've done this evening. After all, European judicial overreach is unlikely to protect and solidify the vital contribution which the convention system has made to the betterment of lives and good governance for over seven decades across our continent. However, it's also incumbent on me as a Strasbourg judge to stress, as stated clearly by the Member States in the Copenhagen Declaration of 2018, that the ultimate goal of the court which I serve is the effective protection of human rights in Europe. In accordance with Article 34 of the Convention, individuals will continue to lodge applications, and violations will continue to be found by judges like me, where respect for convention guarantees is found to be wanting. In addition, in exceptional cases where there is an imminent risk of irreparable harm, interim measures may be applied. Those measures play a vital role in avoiding irreversible situations. They ensure that national courts and/or the Strasbourg Court can properly examine convention complaints and, where appropriate, secure to the applicant the practical and effective benefit of the convention rights asserted. The principle of subsidiarity is not intended to limit or to weaken human rights protection. Instead, it underlines, as I stressed throughout my talk this evening, that the primary responsibility of national authorities is to guarantee convention rights in the first place. Writing in 2017 in defence of the continued utility and value of international human rights mechanisms, including the Strasbourg Court, Philip Leach said as follows: human rights systems represent a complex web of interaction and interdependence between institutional actors, both domestic and supranational, each of which has different functions, expertise, and competences. No one of these actors could secure the objectives of the system alone. This complex but fruitful interaction and interdependence is borne out by the case law of the Strasbourg Court for over seven decades and by the well-established and effective relationship which the court has developed with the UK courts throughout those years. I'm going to conclude with an extract from the Thomas More lecture delivered by Lord Mance at Lincoln's Inn in October 2022. He said, and I quote, "Governments can always point to particular judicial decisions that irritate or incommode them. So too can judges. No court, judge, person, or institution is perfect, but that is not a reason for abandoning or damaging a generally sound system, still less a hitherto sound institution or relationship. And I pray that the good judge will not object to the words he coined in the previous debate relating to the Human Rights Act being transposed to defend more broadly the soundness and the continued value of the convention system for the protection of human rights in this jurisdiction and well beyond." Thank you very much for your attention.